to 27 Rouge. This is the second installment of my series on the Venice Film Festival, focusing chiefly on virtual reality as an exciting new means of creative storytelling. My last episode consisted of an interview with Thomas Vaupeau. This one features three truly talented and exceptional individuals with whom I had the pleasure and good fortune of speaking. They are French director Mélanie Cortina, Project All Unsaved Progress Will Be Lost, American-born, Taipei-based director Craig Quintero of Riverbed Theatre, Project All That Remains, and French producer Marie Blondieu of Red Corner, Project Fight Back, directed by Céline Tricard of Lucid Dreams Productions.
Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Yeah. My first question is just about what inspired you to create this project.
I think I gain inspiration mostly from thinking about the gameplay mechanism in video games. Before thinking of a story, I think about gameplay and I think about the emotions that arouse from some principles like the checkpoints, the PNGs, or the out of bounds. Every concept like this makes me feel a certain way, and I believe this one was inspired by what I felt when I was younger playing games and saving the games, because nowadays with video games the checkpoints, the save points are sort of disappearing, the game saves by itself. But when I was younger it was very physical. You had to literally walk into a circle, a shiny circle, or touch a crystal. And there was always a message when you wanted to save and quit the game, like, are you sure you want to quit the game? All unsafe progress will be lost. And this is the actual title of the project, which was inspired by these moments in the games, these experiences and what they made me feel.
Do you think there's a parallel for that in real life? All unsaved progress will be lost? Some might say, you know, everything you do, even if you get fired from your job or if a relationship ends or whatever, it wasn't for nothing because you learned something. But do you go to the video game world, or like the older video game world as you were talking about, and if you don't like click save, I remember on like Word documents back in the day you had to like save everything. Now, as you said, there's autosave. It's almost the opposite in the outside of the screen, right? Mm-hmm. Or not, or I don't know, how does that dichotomy work?
I believe that when you're in a game, when I was in the games, I tend to be really involved in what's happening. Like if I'm playing a knight that want to save a princess, I am the knight. I'm super first degree when I play, and so when this message appears, it's a weird way to say, to ask the player if they're sure to want to quit the game. All unsafe progress will be lost. There's something really sort of weirdly deep, like misplaced gravity in the formulation that made me feel quite weird, because I was enjoying my time. I felt like in a safe haven. And right now this message reminds me that I'm coming back to the reality and the really tangible and violent reality. And it's this, there's a waking up effect, something like, I would explain it as, I feel out of a safe place, out of a safe Eden. And the safe Eden I'm talking about is actually what I'm showing in the piece. This garden in which my character decided to stay in.
Right. No, it's sort of interesting to think about. It's almost a luxury. Some people, you know, if they don't like the way it's going, the way the game is going, they can just, you know, like a cat, jump off and have another life. They can just wipe the slate clean. But you can never do that in real life. Most of the time anyway. So it's, I don't know, that I was thinking about that in the experience. One other question I had here was about like the medium of VR. There's lots of different storytelling modes that you can use to tell a story or share a story, written, visual, audio, visual. But you talked about a little bit in the synopsis that VR was a particularly suitable format for the story. Why is that?
To tell a story so intense and so emotional, I feel like VR was the perfect medium. It's so powerful. The first time I tried it, it was in 2016, I felt immediately compelled by the strength of the medium. I was trying at the time Google Toothbrush, I think, in the HTC 5, and immediately when I put on the headset, I was somewhere else. Somewhere else where I could literally create my own world and sort of escape. And that felt so powerful. I think it's a power that people that haven't experienced VR yet can't quite understand. That's why it's my favorite medium, the power and the strong immersive capacities of it.
Mm. Yeah, it was immersive. I remember just like looking around. The one thing in it that really stuck out to me was the door knocking. Like, because I was turning my heads when the soldiers are knocking on doors. It was scary, like confronting.
Because it allows us to do an audiovisual experience, but more than cinema, you have this immersive sound, this binaural sound that makes the sound you're telling me about. I was allowed to place it on the space behind your head. Mm. Wherever you look,
yeah,
it will always be there. I like the fact that this technology is super aware of the existence and presence of the spectator, of the player, and that everything can revolve around the spectator.
Mm. Yeah, it's. I mean, you are the isolated person in the story, just like the narrator. Like,
yeah,
you're sitting there alone, looking around. What's up with the deer? I was curious about that. Or the elk, or I don't know what.
Yeah, the deers.
Venison. Yeah, the deers.
I'm not sure I can tell a lot about this without spoiling the experience, because I really like to keep the final information, what it is based on, at the end. So telling you about the symbolism of the deer, of the fawn, would perhaps spoil it.
No, that's fine. No worries. Okay. No, I remember seeing it at the beginning and sort of wondering, what is he doing here? And then at the end, it made sense a little bit more. What kind of, or what is the sonic integration you're using, and what is the significance of it in this work?
Sonic?
The sound, like the software for the sound.
In this project, I did all the visuals myself, but I haven't done I did a little bit of sound design as much as I could, like the soldiers. But the two pieces of music you can hear were actually made by a good friend of mine, Yatoni. I'm not sure what he does. I literally just call him and I'm like, I want music. And he's like, okay, what do you want? And I'm allowed to tell him with my non-musical words what I think about using words like, I want it hard, I want it soft, I want it deep, I want it emotional. And then he was allowed to create the pieces of music, but I'm not sure what software he used.
Mm. Yeah, I'm not sure either.
And me, I just found noises online, and then I use Unity as a software to create the whole experience. I take the noise, I put them in Unity, and then I use Unity to place them around.
Is this a story in the end about like hopefulness or hopelessness? I don't know if the question makes sense, but is it is there a sliver of optimism there of, you know, coming to terms with being alone, knowing that no one else is going to return?
I don't think so. I often like to let the spectator decide what they think, if they want to see hope, good for them. But in my opinion, it's not a story about resilience, about coming to terms with the situation. Because in the end, the woman tells the people never came back. They told her they would, but no one came. And now she's just waiting for death. It doesn't really seem optimistic.
No. Yeah. Is there an acceptance of the... I mean, it's up to the viewer, I guess. But is there... to resign yourself to that fate?
I don't feel like the main character is resigned herself. She feels a bit...
She still thinks maybe, or hopes maybe.
And she's a bit... She's still sad about it. I'm not sure she came to terms with her own loneliness or abandonment or with everything that happened. I don't think so.
I think that's good. Sometimes, particularly in film or television, everyone always wants to, you know, leave feeling happy, or there's a tendency nowadays for, not so much in visual art, but in not so much in like painting, but particularly in film, everyone tries to see the bright side or the silver lining. But I liked that it was raw and visceral, and it didn't pretend to have a silver lining. It's a sad situation.
I mean, it's inspired by real facts, and sometimes in reality, there's no happy ending whatsoever.
It's a good way of putting it. Yeah. I think, I forget who said it, if you want a happy ending, it depends on where you end the story.
Yeah.
What do you hope people will take away from the project?
I'm going to be very honest. When I show it to people and they take off the headset and I can see their eyes a bit tearful, I'm happy. Because at least they felt something strong. Mm. Yesterday, someone I really care about tried the project in Venice, and he took off the headset and he cried. And I'm convinced that VR is super powerful to bring, as I said, strong experiences, strong emotions. So I'm quite happy that he felt so moved that he cried. So there's no, as I said, I can leave the ending to interpretation if someone wants to see a happy ending. I mean, the end is that this awful event happens and we're terrible and she's going to be alone and die alone. Not quite a happy ending to me, but if someone wants to see a happy ending, good for them. But so it's not really about the message I want to give. It's more like I want them to have felt something really strong, have understood something quite intimate and deep I want to give them.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, so we've been doing these immersive performances for an audience of one for the past 11 years. I have a theater company based in Taiwan, Riverbed Theater. And so part of it was really sort of thinking about, like, how do we create an encounter with the audience? And so much of, like, if you're an actor on stage, you sort of perform into the darkness, and you perform for the abstract audience or the audience in general, and really wanted to create a moment of connection between the performers and the person in front of them, to like actually see them and be seen. And so we did this for about 11 years, and it was like really sort of amazing for the audience, and like people would be like in tears coming out of the shows, or people just sort of sitting silently for half an hour. I mean, some of these pieces were 45 minutes long.
Yeah.
And so 10 performers performing for one person. And so really intense, but obviously difficult to sustain this model. So if we have 10 performers and a set and lighting and all the other elements for one audience member, unless we charge like $5,000 per ticket, it's hard to sustain. And so we started thinking, well, what's a model to sort of be able to continue this? And so we made the shift to VR. So it's our first virtual reality film.
Right.
And in it, we're trying to bring this idea of this intimacy or connection from the stage, or these one-on-one performances, to VR. Mm. And so in it, it's really about trying to it's not like maintaining the fourth wall like in theater. Like I'm seeing these people, but you're engaged with them. And so in that moment where the performer reaches into like a wound,
yeah,
and extracts a key, which you're referring to, we actually in rehearsals, we had her reach in and pull out, is it a knife? Is it a poem? Is it a word, like a message, a secret message?
Mm.
And sort of went through about like 10
iterations,
right?
Yeah.
And in the end, the key seemed to be something where, I mean, like you can lock or unlock something.
Yeah.
Right? And so we don't start off with like a set script or a set, like this is a story about. We sort of arrive at a moment and then ask the question like, and then?
Right.
And then we respond, oh, it's a key. Oh, so then she unlocks. And then what happens? Oh, and then this room comes together. And I think then once we made that decision, they're like, oh, we should have more keys, right? So how many times has this happened? Or what are those other keys? Or how many, you know, is this a ritual? Is this something that's been, yeah. So anyway, and it's, I think as an artist, the idea of like leaving more questions,
yeah,
instead of giving answers, right?
You don't want to baby your audience, right, and like over-explain everything. Yeah. Well, that's the beauty of the art is, yeah, like letting each person who watches it have a, you know, take away from it what they will.
Right, right, right. Because I think so much of life, I mean, you have a teacher, you have a boss, you have a film that's telling you this is like the laugh moment, or like as doing a theater director, I mean, you read a script, you know the laugh lines, you know the lines where the audience is supposed to cry, and it's sort of like a, you know, like a painting by numbers, like this is a laugh, this is a cry, and we all should respond at the same moment.
Right.
And with this, it's sort of really creating these series of moments and like, you know, what triggers or what sort of gets into the audience and helps them sort of re-engage the work or re-engage themselves.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, it reminds me of, there was a production of, I think, well, it wasn't exactly Macbeth, it was Sleep No More did a production, yeah, and I'm from,
yeah,
New York.
Yeah, okay.
And that was the first immersive theater, right. Right. The old kind.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Pre-technology, back in the dinosaur days, yeah, when I was, yeah, coming of age.
Yeah.
You know, and that was the first time I experienced something,
yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
So now, I mean, there's this whole other world of possibility,
right.
And this is what you're tapping into.
Yeah. And so, and again, we were, you guys mentioned we've been doing this for 11 years, and I saw like Sleep
You've been doing VR stuff.
The audience support, yeah, performances,
yeah,
for 11 years. And so this is our first transition to VR.
Mm.
And again, it's like thinking about, yeah, sustainable models, like with work like this, if we, you know, we could rebuild the set, we could do an installation here. Like I just saw the work Encontro where they have like this room you're walking through and they've done like an installation.
Yeah.
But then it starts, we need actors, we need to build the set. And with VR.
And money.
And money. And with VR, I mean, you can create the work. And, you know, here we are in Venice and we're just talking to someone in Luxembourg and then someone in Montreal. And so being able to share the work with a broader audience. And so I think that's something really with, for us, for VR, it's taking this work that we've been doing, you know, for over 10 years in Taiwan and now sharing it with the world.
Hmm. So your background is not in...
Is in theater.
Is in theater.
Yeah.
Right. See, that's interesting to me. That's really... My background isn't as a journalist. I,
right,
started off as a writer. I was,
okay,
writing books.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
And then I fell into journalism by accident. But, I mean, do you need, like, a technical background? Or how do you...
So we have, like...
You're, like, the project manager,
yeah, so
steering the ship?
Yes,
yeah, so how does the transition...
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I'm asking half for, yeah, myself, half, yeah, out of interest. Like, it's, yeah, interesting.
Right, so I'm the artistic director of Riverbed Theater, which is the company we formed in Taiwan 24 years ago.
Yes.
And so we've been doing theater for 24 years. Mm. And so... with this project of Just For You performing for an audience of one, you know, we've been constantly, well, how do we, can this be a movie? Can this be a film? But if it's film, you just have, you know, one direction. And we really wanted it to be sort of immersive. And so we contacted, in Taiwan, there's this government organization, the Taiwan Creative Culture Agency.
Mm.
And so they had a competitive grant, so we applied for that, received funding. And then in terms of the technology, we found this company in Taiwan, Funique. They do amazing work. So check out their company, Funique, Funique.
Mm.
And just in terms of the use of the Titan camera, so it's 8 lenses, they do the stitching. And so again, with the technology, I have no idea what sort of like the logistics of what happens. Like post-production takes 2 months for them to stitch the different.
Well, what
cameras.
Do? You go in and you talk with the team and you sort of describe what you want, maybe with some sketches.
Yeah,
and
so I created like a PowerPoint. So with like a SketchUp, I did 3D models of,
yeah,
the set, and then we sort of in there are included people. And so there's like, well, this is maybe a problematic, so they're too close to the camera or too far away, or they have different like blind spots. Mm. So with the cameras, if you move, because there's eight lenses, if you move between the lenses of where they're filming, then you're in a blind spot. And if you do that, then when they're stitching it together, it's really difficult because you're like sort of between two frames or two lenses. And so they're helping really resolve technical issues. In terms of the artistic process, sort of I wrote the script and designed it, and then they help facilitate the technical.
How did you design it if you don't?
So I designed, for our theater company, I designed most of our sets. So I designed like for the room that pushes together, or in the second room, the turning, how you're sort of having like a panning shot.
Oh, is that an actual room?
Yeah,
I thought it was CPU.
No.
Computer generated.
Yeah.
Oh, it's real.
Yeah.
It's a wood. There's wooden tables. Those are
so everything
real.
Was real. Everything was real.
I thought it was very high quality. CPI.
So
no.
It was all we.
Or CGI. Oh wow. Okay. That's interesting. Yeah. It was funny. I was interviewing a guy yesterday. Thomas Villepoe, he has mandala here, and he was telling me a funny story about. He had some installation somewhere, and someone came out saying, "Wow, that's the best AI I've ever heard." And he was laughing. He's like, "It's not AI; it's a real person."
Yeah,
that makes sense.
Yeah.
Sorry, my question. I feel stupid.
No. A number of people have walked out the same thing. It's like, how are you creating the 3D model? And I think it's interesting though, because in VR, because it's virtual, right? And so it's not physically present. And so I think that on one hand, we lose something when we're transitioning from a live performance to VR, but we also gain something because it's so close to you. Like the sound is in your ears, the sight is like, the Oculus is on your head. And so there's a physical connection with it, which I think is heightened more than like the two of us are sitting here on couches talking to each other, and there's maybe like 60 centimeters between us. But like, if this was in VR, I think it might be even more intense, or it would be altered, right?
The woman got a bit too close to me, and then I stepped back, and I was like, this will create distance,
but it doesn't. Right?
No, it doesn't. There's no escape.
So when I showed it to my sister-in-law, and she was watching, she hadn't watched VR before, she was watching it, she actually ended up backing up maybe about 6 feet.
Yeah.
And then the second room, she's turning, and then when the final scene, she also backed up about another 3 feet.
Right.
And it's like as if I couldn't escape, but I mean, you can't, right? It's there, and like, that relationship stays the same. Right?
There is no escape.
Yeah.
That's the idea.
Yeah.
So what is this project about?
I think it's a great question. I go into a piece and I don't start off with it, but this is a piece about, we work and create these series of images. And so I think that in the end, hopefully, something emotionally happens, or it maybe opens up like a memory or a sense of like an emotional or mental state. And so it's less about A or B or C, or it's not a love story, it's not about love. I mean, it's just sort of creating this reflective space. So in the same way that if you looked up at like a blue sky and you're like, oh, this is beautiful, or it reminds me of going camping in upstate New York with my parents and we were at this lake that we always used to go to, or it reminds me of when I was in Paris and whatever it is, it takes you into yourself. And so it's less about a performance about like, oh, these characters and their experiences. Mm-hmm. And it's more, it becomes like a mirror to see oneself. Right?
It's quite dark. For me, my experience, it wasn't camping at the lake and in the woods.
Yeah, so it wasn't blue sky.
Yeah.
So overcast. Yeah.
Overcast. No, not a bad thing. I think it's quite a good thing. I don't want, I don't need like Mario Kart. I don't know. I think you're right. It was evocative in a lot of ways, but I'm not sure what it was evocative of.
Yeah.
And I think a variety of things, but that's the point. It's a vehicle.
And I think sometimes in the end, as folks maybe watch it the first time and they're like, "Huh, well," and maybe I don't get it because I think we're used to it sort of getting something. And I think that maybe if we can let go of the need for it to mean, and just sort of like that was an experience.
Yeah.
Right? And that happened. And I think that if we can let go of maybe the need to interpret and just sort of let it be, right? And I think, and if we let it be, then eventually we maybe will give it a meaning, or we will think that, but it's sort of removing that need to explain it.
Are you American or Canadian, or what's the American, what's the accent? American.
Yeah.
From where?
I was born in Montana.
Montana.
And,
okay.
Grew up outside of Chicago.
Yeah. Okay. No, I'm from New York.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
why.
Yeah.
Not really relevant to the interview, but just
yeah,
curious.
Yeah.
Like you never know
yeah.
where people are from,
yeah.
but yeah, fascinating. And do you think there's potential for a sort of? I mean, you know, I've seen a lot of different kinds of exhibitions here, worlds,
right.
Collaborative stuff, interactive
right.
stuff. Do you think there's a potential for having audience members interact with each other, or audience members interact with
right.
live actors? And not necessarily
yeah.
on this project,
yeah.
maybe on a future
yeah.
one or another iteration of this.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, again, so we've been doing with live actors, with audience interaction, and that was sort of like the initial model that we're moving from.
The Sleep No More stuff.
Yeah, sort of like these performances for an audience of one. That
yeah, no headset.
Yeah. yeah, with no headset. And
yeah.
you're sort of
yes.
in the real space. And so, again, we've had like 10 performers performing for one person.
Really?
And so very intense. We did this one piece in a hotel where it's like... started at 1 a.m. and so every half hour we do the show, and it started in the lobby, and then they'd be led to the elevator, they go up the elevator to a bar on the third floor, and then up to the fifth floor and into a room and another room. And so each half hour we'd sort of loop our performance, and so we'd end at 6:30, so every night we performed I think five times or six times. And and again, it's kind of amazing. Like the hotel let us use this, and it's like one night there was like these drunk Japanese businessmen that were coming through, and like, Ar-da-da-da. And so the audience thought that they were part of our show. Like, oh, those guys were so great. Like, they were great, but that was reality, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's like, you know, sort of the music of chance, right? And so I think that there's definitely like this the possibility for a theater model. But I think what's important for us, at least, is like as an audience of one, because you can't turn and talk to your buddy like, oh, what do you think about this? Or like roll your eyes or and then afterwards, you sort of have to process it on your own because no one else experienced it with you. And so I think that sometimes even for performances, audience of one, they'd ask like, oh, can we bring my friend? Like, no, that's not one. Right. And so like with these performances, everyone's eyes are directed at you.
Hmm.
So even in this scene, like the first scene when the two guys pass you and then they turn, they're both looking at you, not you and your friend.
Yeah, and even when they pass you, they're
yeah,
still
they're looking at you, right?
Creepy.
And so it's like you're everything.
It's
yeah, yeah,
that creepy.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And so if you had two people, then it doesn't function the same way. So I could imagine.
Yes. There's one vantage.
Right.
You're the focal point. Yeah.
And it's all just for you, right? And I think that having that focus, that connection with the individual audience is really important for this type of project. I could imagine something different. But like right now, we're going to do a trilogy of these. So this is our first one, All That Remains. We've already shot our second one, Over the Rainbow.
Okay.
And we're going to start working on our third one next year.
Interesting. Where is Over the Rainbow showing?
We just finished filming it like 3 weeks ago.
Okay.
And so we're going into the post-production
stage. Yeah, cool.
But after this podcast, I think you'll get us invited to Tribeca.
Everywhere.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean...
Say Scott, and then we're in.
Yeah, so well, you just have to say S, actually.
Actually, S?
S is enough.
I think so.
They'll know when it comes afterwards.
S-C-O-T-T.
It'll sort of come to them in like an apparition.
Out of a wound, they'll pull out the name instead of a key.
Yes.
I like it.
I want to ask, being respectful of your time and mine, we have like 3 minutes left. I want to ask one or two quick questions. Is how do these projects make money? I've asked everyone this and no one has an answer.
Like in terms of this VR project?
Like VR projects in general. Like.
So I think you can sell it. And
to whom?
So like a distributor. So we were talking to someone from China, and so they pay like a set fee for like 2 years or 5 years.
To be able to license it
to
and
license
do whatever
and they
want.
Can distribute it within the country. And so there's like a normally, this is my limited understanding, but there's like a time period. So it's like a 2 year or 5 year window.
They own it.
And then I think of that, they take 30% of then the profits of sales, and you get 70%. And obviously, that would be something.
What do they sell? That's what I'm like.
So I think like people.
What happens?
Yeah. So I mean, like on an Oculus, you can buy films.
Yeah.
And so you could put it on your Oculus, and people could watch it. Again, this is not like I don't think our movie is like. Let's have a party. Let's watch All That Remains.
It's art.
Yeah, yeah. And so it says, yeah. So it's something that you could experience when people come over. You could show them. They could watch and rewatch. And so I think that there is sort of a growing market for this. Again, to recoup the total expenses, we'd probably have to sell like in like 5 countries to be able to recoup the investment to make the project. But again, hopefully as the market grows, more people will be buying Oculus, more people will be seeking this encounter. And again, like when you think about the pandemic, and so we can't go see theater, if these projects can enter your home.
Excellent point.
Right, and you can sort of see it on your own. Right?
Yeah. No, that's not a targeted question for you. Yeah. I'm asking everyone that because I'm curious. Yeah. I write mostly about film. So this is all new to me as well.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I guess about the future, I want to ask finally, where do you see immersive theater going, perhaps? Mm-hmm. Not even where do you see it going. Where would you like to go with immersive theater?
Yeah, so I mean, I'd like to complete this trilogy. And then from there, I mean, I think so much this idea of like going into a darkened theater and watching a show, you know, I don't think that's really what the audiences are hungry for. When you look at the success of Sleep No More, which was going to be like, you know, a 5-week performance, and it's turned into like a 8 or 10 year, and tickets cost $120 or whatever it is, and they're packed every night. And people have seen it 100 times, right? I think that we're hungry for encounters. And I think with Sleep No More and some of this work, it's less about let's do a play the way it was done 2,000 years ago. Let's reconstruct a Shakespearean work, right? And I think that the more open-ended we can sort of leave space, leave the audience their own space within the work, I think that there's a lot of potential for that and sort of, you know, this new direction that we're heading towards.
Yeah. Well, Craig, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, it's a pleasure talking with you.
How did you get interested in VR and come to where you are today? Who is Marie Blondieu?
Who is Marie Blondieu? The way is a little bit long, but I had a lot of fun
everything. Don't spare us the details. I'm interested.
No, everything is about curiosity in a way, meaning that what I've done is trying to know more about different fields of creation. I've worked for publishing, for the Ministry of Culture, for the TV in development, for web, radio broadcast. And my associates at the time, and they are still documentary producers, and they were looking for someone to build a company for new media. And what happened is that we worked on few, let's say, web documentaries, but in fact, it was already interactive experiences or game. And then VR came in 2014, and we were ready to design a beautiful narrative experience, probably before other countries, because France is a super ecosystem and through the grants and through the engagement of Arte, France Télévisions, and all the public services, we were absolutely ready to tell stories with new tech. Mm. And from that, we were also able to take some risks. Mm. I mean that we developed 2 VR experiences before the headsets being on the market. It was a kind of, tiptoe things, but we managed to do it. And from that, we've made international co-productions. The more recent is 4 Feet High, co-produced with Argentina. I also co-produced with US, Canada. So the let's say that the playground of Red Corner is super large. Mm. I'm super happy with that. We have like a way to produce together that is super easy because we are used to work on the same game engine. And on my way, I did some VR titles, but also AR. Mm. And right now I'm still working on 2 things in Red Corner, which are big, ambitious public services experience. Okay. I just make augmented reality experiences for children in libraries.
Okay.
And I also make some experimental games only working on audio. Mm. So this is Red Corner. And we've just funded with Céline Tricard a new video game studio that is to address the video game market. Feedback, we'll have probably follow up on with Coven, and we are super happy to have this new field to explore that is purely video game, and that's very important for us to be two female leaders in the new company, and we have many projects that are on tracks. Yeah,
video games with headset or without headset?
Both. Yeah.
Ah, okay. Right, as you said, you don't draw a distinction. But I am curious about the distinction, if there is one, between VR and AR. What's the difference between augmented reality and virtual reality?
Oh, virtual reality is made to put you into a perfect, coherent environment. I mean, a perfect virtual environment.
Yeah.
So you are surrounded by the
360.
Yeah. Exactly. And AR is about having virtual elements appearing in your reality.
Ah, like Google Glass.
Yeah. Or like Pokemon Go, or like anything that can put in relation your environment and virtual elements.
Okay, so like at the museum when you listen to a description of the painting?
Could be considered as augmented reality. You're perfectly right.
No, and I'm asking.
No. Yeah, in fact, this is more about visual element. Most of the time, augmented reality is about virtual visual elements.
But how do you do that without a headset?
On your mobile, as Pokemon Go, you can find some super weird, strange creature appearing in front of your desk. I mean, kind of thing.
And then I wanted to ask about co-productions. I'm looking at some of the posters in their office here that the people on this audio podcast cannot see, and you've mentioned. I know you've worked with people in Argentina and Canada and the US. How is it co-producing these very complex projects across countries? I mean, time zones are the tip of the iceberg. You're managing, as a producer, a very complex team. There's lots of different moving pieces. Could you talk a little bit about what co-productions are like in the virtual reality world, how you approach them?
Transnational
co-production.
So international co-productions are like any co-production. It's about finding the right partner and having this tango between what I can do, what are my forces, and what do you do best. I would say that international co-producing is trying to find the right way to distribute the tasks, the skills. And in fact, it's not a question of ecosystem. Technically, that's not true, because we share exactly the same kind of game engines. We can find people that understand on both countries how does it work, so no problem. The other question is, how do you put creatively these assets at their best, and their best is you can find setup where there are some configuration where creator from France can challenge Canadian, and Canadian can challenge French with no problem, because we have this kind of common playground, common imaginary in a way. So I would say that for most of the aspects, it's not super complex because of high tech. It's like, as in the film industry, it's just to find the right partner and know exactly how to distribute the tasks, and that's it.
Yeah, well, I mean, easier said than done.
Yeah.
How do you go about finding the right partner? What kind of synergies do you look for? I mean, creative vision or capabilities between the two studios, or both, or other things?
Honestly, for co-productions, what you have to look for is a project where you have a space to express yourself or to express the talents you are working with. I mean, the best opportunities are like this. So sometimes it's difficult to define what is exactly the assets you are absolutely better at. Would you say that?
Yeah.
So sometimes it's difficult to say exactly at the beginning of a project, namely to say, okay, I can bring that and it will be for sure the best way to put it. And honestly, trying to define a lineup into the diversity of contents we can do now with VR, AR, interactive project, video game, that's super difficult. And it's exactly at that moment where I would say instinct or taste, your own taste, has a lot of importance. I mean, there are projects you just heard of and you love them.
You look for synergies. It's hard to describe what that is, though. This is fascinating. It's fascinating for me to hear about, especially like how these stories come to life. You know, you draw on such a rich reservoir, I guess. I mean, the basis of this is like there's a whole galaxy. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, the forgotten stories, the darkness, the metaphor there, without, I guess, giving too much away? The metaphor between, you know, these stories get drowned out and the light gets drowned out in the vast sea of stars in the cosmos.
Oh, going back to Fight Back. I mean, Fight Back is about...
It just popped into my head.
Fight Back, in a way, when I look at it right now, and that was the basic intention, it is about taking back the stories of the star. Mm. Stars and the constellation's name, for an example, are just made of woman suffering. The constellation of Cassiope is an Ethiopian queen hanging in a reverse way, and you have plenty of them. So Fight Back was designed in thinking, okay, the same way you can't count stars in the sky, the same way you will not access to all the story of women that used their power, their force, because we don't have access to their narratives anymore. These stories has been forgotten. And part of the outboarding we just made on Fight Back at Venice was about that, giving a card with the silhouette of the stars you will encounter and give that to people for having them sharing it with people that need self-defense lesson, and try to find ways to keep on sharing these stories the most possible so that they are not forgotten again.
Yeah, there's so many stories that are just sort of drowned out by the noise of history. Talk about a little bit about the cards. I'm holding one now. What is the, so there's a physical card component.
But this is fluidic.
Ah, okay. Well,
again,
I won't.
This is the problem when you have this kind of, you know, great shift, or what do you say, that shift at the end.
Yeah. Well, nothing more about that. But yeah, I mean, the story is, or the stories. There is no one story. I think everyone that experiences this will come away with something slightly different, and will speak to everyone in a slightly different way, you know, based on where they're from, what their experiences are. And that's the beauty of great art, is that there is no one experience that everyone's going to have.
And I think globally that, you know, the film industry right now is made of a lot of, you know, female portraits of super strong women, super strong superheroes, female superheroes. What we need now probably is story of collective empowerment. This is what we need now, just to know that ordinary women can do it without any problems. And we can find in each other, not competition, but some enough solidarity to feel strong ourselves. Yeah.
As a group rather than as the one Wonder Woman or whoever.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's a powerful message. And it goes back to the idea that one is never alone, no matter how alone you feel. Well, that, I mean, that wraps up my questions. Is there anything you wanted to talk about that maybe I didn't ask, or any? I think we covered a lot of stuff, but anything else you'd add?
No, I'm super proud of the work we did, and I'm super happy to work with someone like Celine, artist creators like Celine, because of our strength and also her skills as a professional are super large, and I think that this is exactly the kind of profile as directors, people able to coordinate artistic and technical aspects of what we have to do. I think that they are the future of the industry, trying to keep that absolutely aligned. So the power of the piece is totally hers. So I'm super happy to have participated to that.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.